is important to make new friends in court, is it not?
You're so beautiful.
Stop it, you mock me.
If I were a man, I would ravish you.
You have become close to Abigail.
She is a viper. You're jealous.
You must send Abigail away.
I do not want to.
Let's shoot something.
Sometimes it is hard to remember whether you have loaded the pellet or not.
I must take control of my circumstance.
Throw!
I'm on my side. Always.
Favour is a breeze that shifts direction all the time. Then, in an instant, you're back sleeping with a bunch of scabrous whores.
As it turns out, I am capable of much unpleasantness. Did you just look at me?
Look at me! How dare you! Close your eyes!
I could not just stand by and let you destroy me.
You are enjoying all of this, aren't you?
Oh, it is fun to be queen sometimes.
If you do not go, I will start kicking you. And I will not stop.
My dear friend, how good to see you've returned from
hell. I'm sure you shall pass through it one day.
Hi, this is Dana Stevens, Slate's movie critic, here with a Slate spoiler special on The Favourite, the new film from Greek director Yorgos Lanthimos. Here to talk with me about The Favourite, talking to us from Slate Studios in Washington, D.C., is Alexander Petri, a columnist for The Washington Post and a first-time spoiler special helpmate. Hey, Alexander, thanks for coming on.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
I'm really thrilled to talk about this movie with you. I'm such a fan of your column, and I did not know you were a movie person who would be interested in coming in to talk movies. Do you follow movies, new movies?
I have to caveat this by I love new movies, but I also have very bad and very strong taste in movies. So, like, I saw Venom in theaters twice. Like, that's sort of the grain of salt with which all of my opinions should be taken. Because the first time I'm like, oh, I kind of, you know, I expected it to be really bad, and it was only kind of bad. Maybe it's a good movie. I should see it again. And then I saw it again, and it turned out it was not really a good movie. But I'm glad that I had those experiences.
I haven't even seen Venom once, so consider the second time you were seeing it for me.
On average, yeah, we've seen it a time.
A time apiece. And bad taste in movies is great, because that way, if you've come out identifying yourself up front with someone with bad taste, then I can just dismiss your opinions on The Favourite. But before we start, I'm very curious just to do, you know, a back and forth on did you like it or not? Like, on the most simple level, would you send a friend to this movie?
Oh, yeah, I really liked it. I enjoyed both sort of the 18th century artistic framing of it, and also just any opportunity to watch Rachel Weisz be mean to people is worth paying $14 or whatever your movie costs wherever you go.
Yeah, for this, the pure catty banter factor, this movie rates very, very high. But I think it sounds like you liked it more than I did. I mean, I would say that my review of this movie is generally negative, even though almost all the elements of it are admiring. I rave about the performances, the costume design, the production design. Almost everything about it is kind of gorgeously set out and very wittily presented. But there's something about the whole of it that struck me as show-offy and in love with itself. And I wonder if you sense that at all.
Yeah, a little bit. I feel like I was annoyed by the sort of the chapter headings where it's like, this isn't a textbook. Why are you telling me phrases and like key terms to look for in upcoming scenes? And yet every so often it would just go black and it would tell you phrases and key terms that would be prominently featured in the next scene of the film, which I thought was a little precious. But it was good because it was an aid to reading, and you thought, ah, I got to pay attention because they're going to talk about liking items and taking them.
And and the script is very, I wouldn't call it literary exactly, because it's extremely raunchy and sort of modern. It's not a period piece kind of script, but it is very wordy. It's full of verbal play and, you know, kind of unexpected language choices, including anachronisms. Like, you'll have these 18th century royal characters saying, okay, they said at one point, which sent my mind racing to, what's the etymology of okay again? I'm pretty sure
that's
it's not.
Yeah, that's from like Martin Van Buren. Yeah.
Right. Oh, right. You're the person as the American history knower who would know where OK does come from. But did you notice those anachronisms throughout the movie?
It's funny because my friend and I, when we got out of it, we were arguing, like, was the language anachronistic? Because we're like, maybe they just said the C word a lot more in the 18th century. And we're like, well, we can agree that they definitely did. However, still some of the phrases within that were, like, strikingly not of the time period. But they were so raunchy in ways that are very, like, modern feeling that I was like, maybe I just wasn't paying attention to the specific language used, but
Yeah. No, I think the anachronisms are deliberate and they're part of, you know, destabilizing you, which is also why there are so many show-offy directorial tricks in this movie. The most annoying of them to me being fisheye, the omnipresent use of the fisheye lens, which is, you know, of course, the lens that makes everything look like it's distorted around a kind of glass globe and to me really takes you out of the story. Do you have any theory as to why Lanthimos kept throwing fisheye shots in there?
I had no theory because I read something else where someone was saying, oh, well, like, and it's the comical fisheye lens that really shows you how distorted these people are. And I'm like, well, that, I thought the movie was sort of doing that. I don't think you need to have the fisheye. And suddenly we realize, oh, my gosh, these characters are being satirized. I would not have gotten that if you hadn't used that one distinctive shot. So I, other than that, it was like, it's, I guess, kind of fun if you have a camera in an old house and you get to just roll it around and see what the hallway looks like. But as far as achieving anything additional to what the movie would have achieved without it, I was not like, oh, yeah, that fisheye really pushed me over the edge. I was like, this is what we were missing up until that really long fisheye rolling sequence.
Yeah, to me, it just every single time I just thought there is a director making this at the moment that you see that shot. I mean, I can understand the various aesthetic rationales for it. You could say the people are in a fishbowl, right? The court, the world of the palace court is like a fishbowl. You could say that, you know, he's just trying to get, as you say, a perspective on these huge spaces of these old estates that he's filming on. But for whatever reason, it was one of those movies where I wanted to take the directing with a capital D and just peel it off the movie and just have what was underneath, which was three really great female performances, which we should get to now, and a really good script. So let's get into the movie proper and what actually happens in the setup. We begin in the early 18th century in the court of Queen Anne, who's, I guess you could say, is the main character of the movie. I mean, there's really a triumvirate of women that are all three the main characters. But Queen Anne, played by Olivia Colman, is pretty much the center. And she's triangulated by these two other women, Rachel Weisz, who, as you say, is her very catty advisor, Sarah. I don't know if her last name is Marlborough, but she's married to Lord Churchill. Marlborough. Sarah, yeah. Churchill. Okay. The name, the whole nomenclature is very confusing in the English court. But she is married to Lord Marlborough, who's one of the advisors of the Queen. And she is also a close advisor of the Queen, who, it becomes obvious from the very early scenes, is pulling all the strings behind the scenes and is involved in various machinations to get power for her husband and for the things that she wants, the policy choices that she wants, including pursuing a war with France. And then, well, since I've been talking for so long, why don't you describe who Emma Stone is, the third leg of the triangle?
Yeah, no, Emma Stone is Abigail Masham, I think is her name. I'm not sure her last name is prominent. Well, she becomes
after she marries Masham.
Well, spoiler, she marries a man named Masham. So Abigail, some name that isn't Masham, who is a hard on her luck. She was raised aristocratically, but then her father gambled her away to what she describes as like a fat German with a thin prick. And now she's really on hard times and has been forced to work as a, like, just servant.
A scullery maid, basically, right?
In the grounds of this castle. Yeah, so she's sculling away in the scullery. Now, like, what is the scullery maid? So, yeah, she's using lye on the floors. She's doing all these things. But she's immediately scheming to get back into her former state and maybe even catapult herself beyond that. So while she starts out seeming sort of nice and wide-eyed and has that classic Emma Stone thing going on, pretty soon you notice that she's actually out for bear.
And we haven't even established yet that this triangle is also a love triangle and a sex triangle, right? It's established pretty early on that one of the things that Sarah does, both to curry favor from the Queen and also apparently from some real affection for the Queen, is that she sexually services her, basically, that she is at her beck and call for, you know, any kind of encounter that the Queen is up for. And Abigail susses that out very quickly and decides that she's going to use her physical charms and beauty as well to ascend in the opinion of the Queen.
Yeah, no, she's conveniently in a library, like, looking at books because she's a learned young lass. And then suddenly she notices that in the same room there's this encounter going on. And so then Emma Stone, I enjoy sort of the 18th century efforts at seduction, which are like, oh, I just happened to be waiting here for you. And now I will fling myself into the bed. And oops, my clothes are also gone, which, you know, that's very strategic and direct. And so, yeah, it's remarkably transactional on her end, but it does feel sort of warmer and like, oh, they've been friends for decades and they have these sort of cute formal little names for one another, like Mrs. Morley and Mrs. I forget. I feel like Sarah's name isn't Mrs. Mrs. Morley is the queen, and Sarah has some other name that isn't Mrs. Churchill, but I don't remember what it is.
And it is established that they've been friends since childhood, right? And that the queen sort of depends on Sarah. The queen, we should say, is, I don't know how you would describe the character of the queen, but she's this strange combination of savvy and weak-minded. I mean, she appears to not really have any idea what's going on in the court or what's going on in the larger politics of the nation. And yet she has a hand in everything that happens. She insists on sort of the final decision at all times. She never cedes the power to anyone else, but she also never seems to fully grasp what's happening. And that is also partly because she's in declining health, as we see over the course of the movie. She has gout and she's kind of, I don't know what all she has, but she's sort of bloated and pale and falling apart as the movie goes on.
You know, she's become sort of increasingly grotesque, and at one point, half of her face stops working. And I think, and you can really see the acting going on, but yeah, because she never really seems to take any interest in the business of government. It's amazing for someone who people spend so much time trying to manipulate her. She doesn't really seem to have any core basis for what decisions she's making, other than who happens to be pushing for them at any given time and whether or not she feels favorably disposed towards that person, which is certainly an interesting a sort of ambiguous picture of female power, even as much as the whole show is about female power.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big question about this movie in a way, is like, could you call it a kind of feminist parable or not? I mean, it does seem to, of course, it's about three women who have a great deal of political power and are bargaining it and sharing it and fighting to get it from each other. But ultimately, they are all in the service of a state that's run by men. For example, there's scene after scene that's in, I don't know what you'd call it exactly, but sort of the parliament of its day, like the hall in the palace where the lords come to meet the queen. And, you know, the Tories, who are led by a character played by Nicholas Holt. What's that character's name? Harley.
Lord oh, yeah, Harley. Harley.
They're fighting with the queen about this war that's going on with France, which I should mention we never see a single scene of or really learn much about. It's completely an abstraction, which is obviously a deliberate, I think, commentary on how removed the court is from actual war suffering, you know, everyday political life. But there's this constant battle going on between the Tories and the queen about whether or not this war should continue.
Yeah, it's interesting how remote it is from Parliament. There was something that I had, and I've forgotten what it is now, but I think, so my dad is a huge, he's obsessed with the Duke of Marlborough, like weirdly, like he's gone to the gift shop at the Blenheim Palace and bought all of the books in the gift shop, and he's always like, you know, this man is the first who ever rose from being a commoner to more powerful in the kingdom than the queen, and just all kinds of fun Duke of Marlborough facts. And so I sort of left the movie both wanting to recommend it to him and being like, I'm not certain that you will enjoy all of the, like, it turns out the Duke of Marlborough is not as prominently featured in this movie as maybe you would have hoped, and everyone's having sex.
I would love for your dad to see it. You have to send him to it, if only just to get the response from somebody who knows the history well, because I'm very curious whether it is actually true that his wife was, it is certainly true that she was rumored to be lovers with the queen. In fact, I think those letters really exist, the letters that come along late in the movie and they're discussing whether to burn them or not. I think there are some letters that describe that relationship between them. But as to how that related to the husband, we really don't know, because all the men in this movie, with the slight exception of the Nicholas Holt character, Harley, are distant and barely seen. It really is a world where these three women and the queen's rabbits are essentially the characters that we're meant to care about. Do you want to talk about the queen's rabbits?
Oh, the queen's rabbits. Well, I actually did remember the thing that I was going to say, which is the one thing that really bugged me about the movie, and has bugged me more the more I think about it, was the fact that Emma Stone had to keep delivering like feminist catchphrases throughout the film, which, like, there's one point when she's like, you wouldn't interrupt a man. And it's like, it's the 18th century in England, miss. Of course you'd interrupt a man. Like, you, of course, A, like, the premise that you'd interrupt a woman rather than a man is just a correct premise. And then, so, she was doing all these monologues where she would say empowering things. And nobody else was doing monologues where they were like, yeah, but remember, like, you gotta seize your power. And I felt sort of bad for her, because like all of the acting was great during the normal parts, but then she would have to go off and like deliver a long monologue while pleasuring her new spouse. And I like how like prudish and Victorian I am. I'm like, well, yes, and of course there was sex there. Which sounds on.
But speaking of pleasuring her new spouse, we need to get to that. So how does she go from becoming Abigail, whoever she is, to Abigail Masham? And this is, even though the character himself is kind of a cipher, this relationship is important in her ascent.
Yeah, the queen marries her off in a private ceremony, which is sort of a pivotal point in the movie, but also is historically a thing that did happen. And so now she's restored to a title and is respectable again and is married to Taylor Swift's latest fling,
Joe Alwyn. That's right. Which he was, I would imagine that he was cast in the role before he took up the new blank space in Taylor's notebook. but it ends up being a perfect little rhyme with everyday life, which is kind of delicious, especially because there's something a little Swiftian about this ruthless blonde that Emma Stone plays.
There was also, I feel like, can we talk about I saw in your review you mentioned the nude man with the wig who was getting pelted with pomegranates. Can we talk about the nude man in the wig who was pelted with pomegranates? What was his function?
But wait, we haven't talked about the rabbits yet. And the rabbits are extremely important, especially if we're spoiling, since the last thing we see on screen in the movie is a lap dissolve between Emma Stone's face and a whole bunch of little nibbling rabbits. Can you tell us what the rabbits are doing in this movie?
Yes. Well, the rabbits, they symbolize the lost children of the queen. But also, I can't tell if historically she did this. It seems like they sort of hit the main historical points correctly, where she has one rabbit for each of her dead children. And so,
of which there are 17, incredibly, and that is true as well.
I think that counts
miscarriages. It's all the children that she at one point conceived in her life, some of whom were born and some not.
Which is a lot of rabbits. And they turn out to be the key to her heart. And so when Emma Stone is first sneaking in there and gaining her confidence, it's by playing with the rabbits and saying, oh, and making much of them. Whereas we see Sarah Churchill saying, I think those rabbits are morbid. I think it's creepy that you have them, which later we see Emma Stone's character when we're like, has she made the face heel turn? And she literally crushes a bunny. And so you think, okay, well, it's clear now who she is.
But just to be so our listeners are getting true spoilers, I'm actually going to unspoil that to a certain degree. She doesn't crush the bunny to death. And I feel like that's important to know because some people will not see a movie if animals appear to be tortured and mistreated in it. And even though everybody in this movie is pretty much tortured and mistreated at some point, nobody actually ever kills a bunny, rest assured.
That's true. The bunny is just briefly made uncomfortable, but it seems to survive. And after its initial embarrassment, hops off and goes somewhere pleasant.
But yeah, the rabbits, I think, they're actually something that I love about this movie. This movie's so full of weird touches like that, like the duck race that the movie begins with, which essentially exists just to show us what a debauched and kind of boring world these courtiers live in, that they have nothing to do but bet on duck races. And the rabbits, they serve a similar function in the sense that they kind of illustrate the queen's loneliness and how sort of spoiled she is. But they also, of course, illustrate this tragic part of her life that happened long before the movie begins, where she tried to have children 17 times and it never worked. And so there's definitely an opening onto something more serious and less kind of brittle and comedic once we meet the queen and her rabbits and learn what they mean to her. And then you remember in a different way as well that early scene you talked about where Sir Churchill refuses to have any truck with the rabbits and says, I believe her line is, love has its limits, right? That she's saying, I love you, queen, but I'm not going to deal with this room full of bunnies. And that's a place that Emma Stone is willing to go with the queen, which brings them to this point of greater intimacy.
And that does seem to be a theme that keeps coming up with sort of the contrast between the two of their relationships, where Emma Stone will be willing to indulge the queen's impulses in ways that Rachel Weisz will not. And I'm sorry, these characters have names, but I'm just going full actress, where Rachel will deny hot chocolate to Queen Anne because it's bad for her, and Emma will urge her to sink into a mud bath and drown because if it feels good, do it. And so there is that sort of contrast between what do you want versus what's good for you and what does love really mean. And with the rabbits, initially you think, well, anyone who is mean to this poor woman who's replaced all of her dead children with rabbits, you know, have a little sympathy for the rabbits. But by the end, when those rabbits come back, you begin to sense that maybe Sarah Churchill had a point.
Yeah, well, I guess there's a sense, I think it's hinted in the last scene, which is something that would naturally happen, that the rabbits are breeding, right? She has 17 rabbits to represent the children, but you see this increasing pack of rabbits at the end and this like almost sickening profusion of rabbits. And I think at that point, they're a symbol for something else besides the children, right? They become, I don't know if they kind of represent the vices that are multiplying within the Emma Stone character or the responsibilities and burdens that have devolved upon her shoulders once she gets Rachel Weisz out of there. But yeah, the bunnies by the end just seem like this oppressive evil, sort of.
No, absolutely. I feel like it's sort of the things that you surround yourself with instead of happiness, because like they were always there as a surrogate, and now you have Emma Stone, who's sort of the ultimate surrogate for like maybe what was the love of Queen Anne's life, and even if she was manipulative, but at least she did the books correctly, and like the numbers didn't jump around as Emma Stone complains the numbers do, and if love isn't correctly keeping your lady's books, I don't know what is. But I think also having recently seen The Trouble with Tribbles, that image of the multiplying rabbits was sort of unfortunately evocative. So I'm sitting there sort of in the theater. I think everyone's filled with dawning horror, both that A, the rabbits are multiplying and this is a deep metaphor for what we're going through, but B, oh no, this is going to be the final shot. There isn't going to be any more movie after this. We're really ending with these rabbits here.
If only William Shatner had popped up out of the pile of rabbits, it would have just made the movie.
That's what every movie needs.
All right, but we haven't spoken about the next big plot development after Emma Stone comes in and kind of starts to take over the court and win the queen's affection, which is how she gets Sarah, Rachel Weisz's character, the hell out of there. Let's talk about her subterfuge.
Well, she poisons her tea, which is fairly direct as subterfuges go. And then Rachel goes off into the woods. And it turns out that Emma Stone didn't intend to kill her by doing the poison in the tea. It was like a sort of a small 7-day light poison, some gentle, non-murderous poison. And Rachel Weisz rides off on a horse and falls from the horse and gets stuck in a brothel temporarily and eventually makes her way back to court and now has a hideous scar. And, so
and an eye patch, which is awesome.
Oh, the eye patch was, it was like, that was some serious fashion. Rachel Weisz was making it work beautifully.
Oh, as long as we're mentioning fashion, I should just throw out that I think I said this earlier, but the costumes are fantastic in this movie. I mean, they're period appropriate, but they're also very designy. You know, like, did you notice they're all this kind of black and white color palette? So they almost look like chess pieces or something. There's just, yeah, they're really wonderfully not just matched with the individual actors, but matched with each other, so that when you look at the whole court, it seems to be this sort of like row of dominoes or something. They're fabulous. They're by Sandy Powell, who's kind of the costume genius of our day and will no doubt get an Oscar nomination for this.
No, they were gorgeous. And you're right, the chess pieces thing, that's a really cool way of putting it, because they have all these sort of composed shots where you see everyone in court sort of standing there and you've got the pawns and the queens and just moving around in their square formations. And the costumes really highlight that.
Rachel comes back, eye patch, scar, and now she's really out for blood with Emma Stone.
No, but I want to figure out what happens. So she like poisons her, and then she comes back, and then that's what it is. Rachel's like, okay, I have an ultimatum for you. You need to get rid of Abigail now, and you need to make the war tax increase that I wanted you to make, and this needs to happen, or I'm going to divulge all of our very sensual letters to the public. And this turns out to be overplaying her hand. But then she can't even bring herself to do it. She burns the letters. And then they have a tearful through a door scene where they talk about what love really means. And does it mean indulging your significant other, or does it mean giving them chocolate and not telling them when they look like a badger, when they look like a badger. And that's what Rachel Weisz says love is. And then she gets sent away for good, and they're
exiled from the country, right? I think she and her husband are exiled at the end of the movie.
Yeah, ultimately, because she was supposed to send her a nice letter, and it took her a long time to come up with a nice letter, but she did come up with one, and then sneaky Emma Stone got that letter and burned it. So there's a lot of burned letters in the course of this movie, and that one's a particularly sad one, because they could have reconciled, and poor Olivia Colman sits there going, "Is the mail come today?" But like with a good accent, because she's a talented British actress and not like a Dickensian orphan voice that I'm doing. And the mail never comes, or it does come, but Emma Stone is watchful and she gets that mail. And so then everyone's trapped in hell forever, basically.
Yeah. And when we haven't really talked about the change that comes over the Emma Stone character, but I mean, she starts off the movie scheming, but, you know, still basically someone that you identify with, right? The struggling scullery maid who's trying to find her place at court. But after she gets that power and gets rid of Rachel Weisz, I mean, it becomes almost heavy handed how much it's driven home that power corrupts and that she's become this really not any different than the queen. And if anything, even more appetite driven and amoral than the queen is.
I don't know. I was never really rooting for Emma Stone, to be completely honest. I'm like full team Rachel Weisz here. I'm like, you guys had a working relationship, and like she told you you looked like a badger when you did look like a badger. And like I feel like movies, the one number one mistake classy movies always make is trying to get me to root against Rachel Weisz, and I won't do it. Movies, stop trying. Because even if she's scheming, like when she walks heartbroken down the hallway with a candle, like everyone gets a beautiful like close up when they get to like have their heart break while watching something happen. And I was just fully team get Sarah Churchill back into your life and get the kingdom on board, and you got to keep fighting those French until she says you stop. So I was like, yeah, Emma Stone, your character was always going to go that way from the very first moment you said, oh, cough, cough, I was out picking the herbs to cure you, mistress. Which also, her accent was great. Her accent caused me no problems throughout the film.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we haven't really gotten to this, and this is really the most notable and the best thing about the movie, but all three performances are great. I wouldn't recast or change a single line reading or change anything about the way those actresses interpreted their parts. 100% of my objection to this movie has to do with the way it's framed and presented and sort of its evident self-love, which is seen in things like the fisheye lens and the directorial swooping in touches all the time, and the use of music, which I found a little bit overly obvious and manipulative. It's basically period music, like Baroque court kind of music, but it's just always blasting ironically at you to prove, like, we're at court, artificial things are happening. You know, it's a world of artifice. I get it. I get it. There's an I get it element to this movie that I don't know if you felt as well. Like, I wanted to rewatch it for our conversation because I saw it quite a while ago now. And I did start it and start to watch it again. And then I started to realize, like, I just don't really care about this enough to watch it a second time.
That's fair. I feel like it might annoy me on a second viewing, but I'd be willing to undertake to see whether it would annoy me. I did like, they had a lot of very showy elements, including, like, can we talk about the naked man who is being pelted with pomegranates now? Speaking of directorial choices that show you're at court and are sort of flashy, long sequences with no discernible purpose, other than So my friend and I left the theater and we're like, maybe this happened. And they just had a long list of things that happened at court that seemed too ridiculous to not put in a movie. And then, but you, it turns out Googling like nude man hit with pomegranates, not immediately doesn't go straight to the court of Queen Anne, doesn't give you the information that maybe you were seeking.
I feel like that might take you down some internet pathways that you really don't want to travel down. But yeah, the naked guy being pelted with pomegranates is this very painterly and completely decontextualized moment that happens near the end that I think is just kind of analogous to the duck race. I mean, it's in a part of the movie when more, you know, morally corrupt things are happening. So, you know, now we're seeing a human be used as a toy instead of a bunch of ducks. But it really is establishing the same point, which is just that, you know, everybody at this court is constantly thinking of new refinements because they of kind of debauchery because they have nothing else to do with their lives. And to the extent this movie's really about anything besides just the, you know, delicious triangle of meanness that those three women create, I think it's about that, which I honestly consider a little bit of a thin idea for, you know, a movie this elaborate to be embroidering on, which is just power corrupts and people at court are, you know, bored losers. I mean, Yorgos Lanthimos, the director, has always specialized, all of his movies so far have specialized in this kind of creation of a closed world that makes sense only in itself. Like The Lobster, I don't know if you saw The Lobster, this movie with Colin Farrell from a couple years ago, in which the premise is hard to describe, but essentially it takes place in a world, a kind of fantasy world that posits that if you aren't partnered up, if you don't have, you know, some kind of life partner, then you will be turned into an animal. And and so he's trying to beat the clock so that he won't be turned into a lobster. He's trying to find a woman, a partner, so he won't be turned into a lobster. So,
and they know in advance what animal they're going to get turned into?
I mean, yeah, in the world, no, I think they choose it. I can't remember because I saw it a while ago. But in the world of the movie, it sort of all makes sense and is all this allegory for something very dark and frightening and strange. But then when you walk out, you sort of think, well, what is it an actual allegory for? I mean, that's always been my take on Lanthimos anyway. And so here, we're not in a fantasy world, right? We're in a historical one, but it still seems to be one that operates according to its own bizarre hothouse rules with naked men being pelted with pomegranates. And I'm not quite sure what it all adds up to in the end. Maybe it doesn't need to add up to anything other than just kind of a raunchy court comedy. But anytime that it felt like it was, as you say, trying to take on feminist aspirations or trying to have some larger political allegorical meaning, I just felt it didn't have that many places to go.
I thought it succeeded most when it delved into the relationships, because those three central performances and the three central sort of relationships that it was sort of focusing on were fascinating, and how they were forced to play out in this sort of artificial environment was fascinating. And it was I actually sort of my biggest problem with it was it seemed to think it was a comedy, but I thought it worked best when it was not comedic at all. Like I laughed definitely, but it was at things like, oh, why are they breakdancing now? Or just sort of moments that took me out of the movie rather than moments that like I thought word was strongest was when you were just watching all of these beautiful actresses have their hearts broken and like strutting around with hideous fashion masks. And like that part of the movie was the most successful to me. And so the parts when it was like, ah, but yes, court life, as you say, I think were actually by trying to say more, were just sort of more slapdash and didn't say as much.
Yeah. I mean, I will say that this movie is unusual. It is certainly not like anything else you will see. It's not in any way a Merchant Ivory-esque staid period costume drama. So, you know, if you go with your grandmother on Christmas Day expecting it to be that, she will be possibly horrified by the language and the subject matter. And so it is at least original. And some people are loving it. I mean, I have to say, to be fair to people still trying to decide, I don't know if you would listen to all of this and still not know whether you want to see it or not, but lots of people are walking out of this movie swooning. So, you know, if you really love snappy, raunchy dialogue in 18th century English courts, you should by all means go.
Yeah, absolutely. And even if you don't love those things, if you just want to not see like a festive movie and just the acting, go and watch the acting.
Yeah. And I think also that Olivia Colman is probably going to be a big feature in the awards conversation. It's that kind of performance because, as you say, it has tragic elements and comic elements. It has physical transformation, which Oscar voters always love. If you look at Olivia Colman now, she's kind of like this long, rangy, incredibly sharp featured, you know, kind of glamour cat. And the character that she plays as this queen is this really sort of blurry, out of it woman who seems very kind of out of touch with her own court and with her own body, really.
Yeah, no, there's this whole sequence where she's sadly eating an enormous cake. And then like a lot of people are chundering constantly in this movie, coming to think of it.
Chundering. I feel
like there's a lot of technicolor yawning going on. I feel like sometimes the euphemism's worse than the actual thing. That's what I'm discovering from my contribution today.
But describe the cake. The cake scene is really one that stuck with me afterwards because I can't stand vomiting in films. And it was a particularly gross instance of it.
Yeah, no, she's eating just enormous fist. Well, she has a demure slice of this cake, but she's eating too much of it. And then she vomits into a vase and continues eating the cake. And it's sort of, it's very that thing where you leave a dog in a house by itself and it eats the whole bag of food. And some people are like that if left to their own devices. And other people are cat people where they like have schedules and organize themselves. And as much more of a dog person who would like sort of run amok and doesn't understand why there isn't any cereal in the house after she's eaten all the cereal, I did sympathize for when you lose your Rachel Weisz in a situation like that, of course you're going to eat an entire cake and be confused why you can't have the whole cake and also eat it simultaneously. Oh my God, is that what the expression means?
You finally understand. Yeah, I mean, that scene to me was just making the same point that had been made countless times with the pomegranate guy, with the ducks. I mean, it's just showing the kind of gross, appetitive world of court where there's nothing to do but consume. But Olivia Colman's so good that that scene just still sticks with me as almost the image that I most carried away from the movie, throwing up blue cake into a vase and then chomping down some more.
Yeah, no, because you can see her like that bite of cake afterwards. She's like, this is an ill-advised follow-up bite of cake, but I'm going to do it because I'm the queen. And she is the queen. She can do it. But the point is, should she be doing it? And so, I don't know. I guess I'm just fully in the tank for Sarah Churchill, and I think she should have brought her back to court. And I was very sad when she did not because scheming Emma Stone had stood in their way, which is to say that I definitely enjoyed this movie.
So when The Favorite 2 comes out and Rachel Weisz comes back for her revenge, you have to come back and talk to me again.
Oh, yeah. No, Sarah Churchill, ride or die.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining me, Alexandra. I really do hope you'll come back. Whether or not there's a Favorite 2, I would love to spoil another movie with you sometime soon.
Well, thank you for having me.
It was great fun. Thank you for listening to this Slate Spoiler Special. If you have any ideas for future movies or TV shows you would like us to spoil, you can drop us a line at spoilers@slate.com. You can also subscribe to the Slate Spoiler Special podcast feed on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Our producer today was Danielle Hewitt. For Alexandra Petri, I'm Dana Stevens. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.